Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm actually very happy to be back at Perimeter. I spent a couple of months a few years ago there, and I enjoyed it very, very much. So, well, what I would like to talk to you about is a program that I've been pushing for many, many years now. And so I should start by just at least pointing out to the fact that there are many people that have been very involved at various stages of this program. And the talk will be based on two papers that culminate, the culmination of all that work. All the papers are in the archive, published in the journal Entropy. These two are published in the journal Entropy and provide like the latest versions of entropic dynamics. Also, I will not be mentioning too many references to the work of other people. So references are provided in those papers. So to give you a quick overview of where all of this approach to quantum mechanics lands, I would like to just write down a few interpretations of quantum mechanics that are out there, and I will put them on a table. And then I'll show where entropic dynamics fits into this scheme, or better, doesn't fit into this scheme. You could classify the various interpretations of quantum mechanics as being realist or anti-realist. And roughly by what I mean by this is whether there are the values of observables are, whether observables have values that are pre-existent to any measurement, or whether the values are sort of like created by the act of measurement. And on the columns, we could classify theories as being according to the epistemic ontic status of the wave function. So for example, if you want the Copenhagen interpretation and cubism and various other variations on this theme would end up as being anti-realist, and the wave function is completely epistemic. If nothing is really real, only created by measurement, but you claim that the wave function is real, then of course nothing would land on that box. If you want to have real quantities floating around and you claim that the wave function itself is real, then there are a number of ways to go about doing that. I do not mean to imply that these ways are satisfactory in other ways. In fact, the fact that there are so many other interpretations means that each one of them is not particularly satisfactory. But there you have the early versions of Schrödinger, or the Bohmian approach, or the many worlds interpretation of Everett. Although one could claim also that Everett may land over here as well, depending on whether the many worlds are real or not. The stochastic mechanics of Nelson might end up here. If one wants to go in the direction of realist, real variables floating out there, like the positions of particles or the values of fields, but the wave function is an epistemic object, then Einstein and Ballantyne more or less fit here. So the great advantage of having a table like this is that it provides you with a quick way of organizing your thinking. The great disadvantage is that it might give you the impression that these possibilities are like completely comprehensive, that they cover all possibilities. And so they might obscure the fact that there may be other alternatives. Like entropic dynamics falls somewhere here in between these two boxes. Entropic dynamics shares with this column the fact that the wave function is going to be completely epistemic, but it shares with, say, for example, the Bohmian interpretation, the fact that particles have actual positions. They have definite values that might conceivably be unknown to us, but they have definite values. So you, as we proceed, you will find that the mathematical formalism shares a number of features with the Bohmian interpretation, or even with the stochastic mechanics of Nelson, except for the fact that the wave function is not real. It's not a real object. Very good. Having placed where entropy dynamics more or less is going to end up. I would start by saying, well, our subject is quantum mechanics. The goal is to derive the mathematical formalism. In the traditional approach, the Hilbert space tends to come first. What that means is that, well, once you have the Hilbert space in hand, you may end up asking yourself lots of questions. Why are there probabilities in the first place? Why indeterminism? Why do we use quantum probabilities, or do we need to use quantum probabilities? Where does the Born rule come from? And then you have the eternal important question is, why do you have two different forms of wave function evolution, linear unitary versus collapsed during measurements? And the ultimate question, of course, is in the standard approaches to quantum mechanics, what ends up being real? It's the question of ontic versus epistemic. What's real and what's not? So what I propose to do here is to follow a different approach in which probabilities comes first. When you do that, a number of the questions that are raised in this context are answered automatically. Why probabilities? Well, why indeterminism? If your theory is of probabilities, of course, that's what you're going to have. The question might get inverted and say, why is it that under some special circumstances, you can have certainty about anything? So in this approach, probability comes first, and that raises a number of questions. Why do we have wave functions? Where do they come from? Why do we use complex numbers? Why is there a linear unitary evolution? Where does that come from? Why Hilbert spaces? Very good. One way in which this approach, the entropic dynamics approach, is going to differ from many of the other approaches to foundations of quantum mechanics is that rather than taking a given mathematical formalism, Hilbert spaces and all that, and trying to append an interpretation to it, what I do is just the opposite. I start from an interpretation, and then I try to build the mathematical formalism. So the issue of interpretation is settled from the start. What might not be settled is what is the mathematical formalism that leads to quantum mechanics, which means what we can consider here, the basic question is not, or rather, let me put differently, our goal here is not to discover the Schrödinger equation, but rather to discover what are the assumptions that are needed in order to get to the Schrödinger equation. That's the program. Very good. The talk will have two parts, one in which I will discuss basically the kinematical aspects, and then in the second part I will discuss the actual entropic dynamics. Very good. So the starting point is to achieve a clear ontological commitment. We must know what is real, what is ontic from the very beginning. And then we must also know what parts of the formalism are going to represent epistemic concepts and quantities. So we start by being very clear about the separation of those two. One could say that this is where that famous metaphor that people used due to Ed James about the quantum omelette that was scrambled so that we never really know what's real and what is epistemic. It gets unscrambled from the very beginning. We never scramble it, we keep it separate. Very good. We are going to choose ontic microstates. For the sake of simplicity, to simplify the mathematics, I'm going to choose discrete ontic states. Here it's gonna be, the microstates are going to be 1 through n. This could actually describe, for example, an n-sided die. The theory can be formulated, and it has been done for continuous variables. We'll do that in the second part of the talk. We've done it for particles. We've done it for fields. So it can one can actually be very, very generous as to the kind of microstates one chooses. Very good. The probabilities, this is the epistemic part of the whole show. We're going to write the probability of phase J, of microstate J. We're going to write it as rho J. This is anticipating that we're going to be doing a fair amount of geometry. So these are going to be coordinates in some space. The probabilities are Bayesian. We are not talking about personalistic Bayesian probabilities. We're talking a little bit more like the Jain's more objective Bayesian approach, which means these Bayesian probabilities are going to represent the degree to which you ought to believe in a certain proposition, like phase J is the correct one. Provided only you were an ideal irrational agent, which we are not, but that's why we're going to follow this objective Bayesian approach. They're definitely not quantum probabilities. In this kind of approach, probabilities are neither classical nor quantum. They're just tools for reasoning, and the tools of inference are going to be exactly the same, whether you are talking about the stock market, or medical trials, or ecosystems, or quantum mechanics. The probability theory is exactly the same. What is going to differ are going to be, of course, the microstates and the various pieces of information that you use in order to make your inferences. Very good. What is going to be the goal in the first part of the talk, the kinematic part? We would like to study curves on the n minus one dimensional simplex of normalized probabilities. And I insist that this part is only a kinematical prelude to the dynamics. The reason I say that is because these curves are just generic curves on this space. In order to be able to talk about a proper dynamics, we are going to have to restrict ourselves to those curves that happen to be trajectories. Namely, the parameter along the curve happens to be time. The Hamiltonian that actually generates displacements along this curve has to be a Hamiltonian that is somehow coordinated to the clocks that you might have for this particular system. So we're going to have to worry about what do we mean by time in a purely inferential theory. That's where the dynamics come. What do you mean by time? How do you pick the appropriate coordinates and the appropriate conjugate momenta and all of that? That's for the second part of the talk. Here, we're just talking about the geometry of these spaces and curves on them. So here goes some geometrical background. Here is the simplex, normalized probabilities. We are a point here is a full probability distribution. And this is going to be the epistemic configuration space, as opposed to these guys over here, which are they form the ontic configuration space. So there we have our epistemic configuration space. We're interested in curves. And of course, we're going to be interested in the tangent vectors of curves, because tangent vectors are going to be, at some point, they're going to be velocities. And if you look at all the possible vectors at the point rho, you have the tangent space. Here we have the components of the velocity vector. This is the tangent space at rho. And if you consider not only the base space, but all the tangent vector, tangent spaces, you have a tangent bundle there. Very good. We can also consider other quantities. Rather than vectors, we could consider covectors. So if you have functions at the point rho, we may want to consider what is the gradient of a certain function. Those gradients are going to be covectors, generic covectors also lie on a tangent space here, the cotangent space at rho. And we may want to know what are these covectors of interest. Here they were velocities. There, we do not know. Typically, we would like to call them momentum, the momentum that's conjugate to rho. In classical mechanics, in classical mechanics, we have a prescription for how to figure out what is the P that is conjugate to those rows. What are the P's that are conjugate to those rows? But here we do not have a Lagrangian. There is no such thing. And so we need another prescription. We're going to assume that we have solved that problem and we have figured out what are the conjugate momenta to the rows that are of interest to do in physics. That is the second part of the talk when I tell you how I pick the appropriate momenta. That's what entropic dynamics contributes to these kinematical descriptions. Very good. To anticipate things, you can already start seeing that there is something that is pulling in the correct direction to get a quantum mechanics. First, I'm going to have not just probabilities, but actually a doubled set of degrees of freedom. So this opens up the possibility of complex numbers. Furthermore, this guy here, at some point in the development, is going to be associated to the magnitude of a wave function, while its conjugate momentum is going to be the phase of the wave function. So as we proceed in this purely geometrical description that has nothing to do with physics, I'm going to point out which of these features are going to emerge later as being pieces of quantum mechanics. Very good. The cotangent bundle, the base space, which is the simplex plus all the cotangent spaces, is going to be the epistemic phase space for our model. Very good. Having done that, some quick notation. A point in this phase space is going to be defined by rho and phi. The coordinates are going to be rho j and phi j. I'm going to use sporadically in various places, I'm going to use a composite index that tells me which phase of the die, which microstate, and whether I'm talking about a probability or the phase. The object phi here, I can call it the momentum conjugate to rho or something. It's somewhat easier if I just start bite the bullet and say, yes, the phases. I'm going to call the rho's probabilities and phi is the phases. Very good. Vectors are on this cotangent bundle on the phase space are going to be defined in the usual way. The components of the vectors are, of course, going to be velocities of some type. We can also define gradients in the usual way. The tilde on the gradient is meant to be there to emphasize that this is the gradient on the phase space, as opposed to when we deal with particles, for example, we may want to have all sorts of gradients in real space, three-dimensional space or 3n-dimensional space. So I'll keep the tilde to remind us that we're talking about the epistemic phase space. And of course, the gradient of the function f, the covector, can be expanded in a way like that. Very good. An important technicality here that seems innocuous enough, but it can end up being absolutely crucial. It's the following. If you look at normalized probabilities, then it's actually not so easy to think about partial derivatives because you want to take a derivative with respect to rho j, keeping all the others fixed. But you can't do that if your probabilities are normalized. So it's going to be much easier if we embed the space of normalized probabilities into the space of unnormalized probabilities. So this extended simplex is just going to be the space of all, it's the positive cone, positive probabilities, not necessarily normalized. All right. Since we have a nice notion of what the coordinates are going to be, rho and phi, we settled that question. We'll come back to it later. We can write down a natural symplectic form. this anti-symmetric tensor. And the anti-symmetric tensor will act on vectors, and we can write that action here in terms of the components of the symplectic form. And it turns out that the components take this standard familiar form of symplectic forms. Very good. Now, we are going to be interested in curves. The curves that are of most interest to us are the curves that are particularly adjusted to the various symmetries or geometries that our phase space might have. If we, the moment we postulate the existence of a symplectic form, then it makes sense to ask, what are those vector fields? I'll use a bar to denote vectors. What are those vector fields such that the symplectic form is preserved along those vector fields? These are going to be called Hamiltonian flows for reasons that, well, are sort of like obvious, but will become apparent in a second. What we have here is a Lie derivative. The Lie derivative of omega with respect to H is zero. And this is just a fancy way to talk about directional derivatives, the directional derivative of a tensor omega in the direction of H. That's what the Lie derivative does for us. So it's just a fancy directional derivative. Very good. These Hamiltonian flows then are such that the symplectic structure is preserved along this vector field. That's going to be one of the central equations in what follows. By Poincaré's lemma, there exists a scalar function, H tilde. This is a scalar function associated to the vector field H. And the property that is crucial about this scalar function is that if you apply omega to the vector H, that's going to be the gradient of this function. So written in English, once you actually use what the components of omega are, what one obtains is that the velocity of rho is given by the h d phi, and the velocity of phi is given by minus the h d rho, which one recognizes as Hamilton's equations. So the beautiful thing about this is that while one might be inclined to think of Hamilton's equations as something that comes from classical mechanics, here I'm not even doing physics. This is just flows in a phase space with a privileged symplectic form. So nothing prevents us from attempting to make such a theory, such a formalism, also work for quantum mechanics. And in fact, indeed, it does work. Furthermore, if one, oh, okay, before I do that, then the name that one associates to this vector field is a Hamiltonian vector field, and the name that one associates to H tilde, to the scalar function, is the Hamiltonian function associated to that vector field. So this is what Hamiltonians are all about, these scalars here. If we apply omega to two of these vector Hamiltonian vector fields, it turns out that the result of that operation is the Poisson bracket of the corresponding Hamiltonian functions. And even more, one can get the fact that if you ask for what is the time derivative or the t derivative along the vector flow, the flow defined by the vector h, it is the Poisson bracket with the corresponding Hamiltonian. So all of this, I'm sure, is very familiar to many of you. I'm just repeating all this in order to set up the notation and also to make it clear that this is just geometry. There is no physics yet. So, but we're talking about spaces that involve probabilities, and these probabilities are in principle supposed to be normalized. And we decided that it would be easier to embed these spaces in spaces of unnormalized probabilities. And so what I'm going to do is talk about this normalization constraint. And the way this works is if we call this the normalization of rho, The normalization constraint can be established or can be formulated in terms of this scalar function n tilde, and the constraint is going to be n tilde equals to zero. Now, why is that of any use? Well, it's because once I have a scalar function, I can use it to generate its corresponding Hamiltonian flow. And when I do that, I figure out what this flow is. It turns out that as you move in the direction of the n bars of these vectors, the probabilities do not change. The parameter along these vector fields is called nu. The probabilities do not change. So you displace along this vector field by a parameter distance nu. Probabilities do not change, but the phases change by nu, by this constant. Notice that there is a j here, but they all change by the same nu, which is a j-independent constant. You might see where this is going, right? If you take a state and you change the phases all by a constant, you are not changing anything in quantum mechanics. Now, how do we get that? Well, it's straightforward, actually. We would like to have Hamiltonians that preserve the normalization. We want flows on the simplex of normalized probability. So we want Hamiltonians that preserve normalization. And if you have that NH is equal to zero, then the Poisson bracket HN is also equal to zero, which means that if N is preserved along H, then H is preserved along N, which we write in this form. So here is the fact that H is preserved along the flow generated by N tilde means that N tilde generates a gauge symmetry, as one might expect. This really reflects rays in the later quantum mechanical description. But one way to think about this object here is the following. We started with normalized probabilities. We increase by one the number of degrees of freedom probabilities. And therefore, we increase by one the number of phases, the number of momenta associated to those probabilities. We would like to get rid of this superfluous degree of freedom. We do that by imposing a constraint. And then we have to also get rid of the superfluous momentum degree of freedom. And we do that by declaring these two guys equivalent. Phi nu and phi zero are equivalent. They belong to the same ray. They lie on the same gauge orbit. Furthermore, H is invariant under these transformations generated by N. So N must be gauge invariant. And this is something that's going to turn out to be important later. All of these things are important later, but you'll see where it comes in. Very good. So far, we have taken care of the symplectic geometry of this statistical manifold and its associated phase space. What I would like to know now is talk about the geometry of this phase space. Now, it turns out that manifolds are not naturally endowed with a metric structure. You have to impose it from the outside. But the glaring exception to this are statistical manifolds, spaces of probability distributions. They do come endowed with an essentially unique metric tensor. Essentially unique, not totally unique. And so, for example, if we have the simplex of normalized probabilities, then the metric tensor is essentially is unique. There isn't that much you can do. You may have different choices of units, but that's a very, very trivial change. For the space of unnormalized probabilities, the metric tensor has a little bit more freedom. There are two scalar functions of the normalization that enter into this metric tensor. The one thing, it looks awful, it looks nasty, but there is one thing that's very nice about this metric tensor in this special written in a particular set of coordinates, which is that this metric tensor shows that the space, the extended space of unnormalized probabilities is spherically symmetric. The space of normalized probabilities is actually a sphere. It's spherical, kind of cute and very important for quantum mechanics. Very good. Now, while it is true that the statistical manifold has a natural geometry, the phase space, the cotangent bundle, is not a statistical manifold. So in order to assign a metric to it, one has to jump through a couple of hoops before we get something decent. We have to make assumptions. The basic assumption I'm going to make is that we are going to assign a geometry to the phase space that is purely determined by the geometry of the base manifold. And the way we do this is the following. If you have these short, small displacements on this phase space that are only in the rho direction, the metric induced then must be the metric that we have here. So we would like the scalar product of these vectors to be the same scalar product that you would have on the statistical manifold. Similarly, for the conjugate momenta, for the covectors, we would like to have also the same inner product that you would get from the information geometry of the base manifold. There is yet a little bit more freedom here, in which we note that there could be, in addition, mixed terms, where again, well, the tensor that appears there is, of course, it's the identity, but it's of course the same that you will get for the base manifold. But there is a possibility of a scalar factor there, a coefficient beta. So in order to manipulate or think better about how do we fix this remaining arbitrariness in the metric of the phase space, I'm going to make an assumption, which is I'm going to impose flow reversal symmetry. Basically, what's going on here is if I have this statistical manifold and I draw a curve on it, I would like to be able to traverse this curve in one direction or traverse it in the opposite direction with the same velocities. I would like to have some kind of time reversal symmetry. And if you think about it that way, the rho under time reversal, the coordinates remain unchanged, but the components of the corresponding momentum will change sign. So the way to guarantee this is to set beta equal to zero, which allows me to get rid of that. And so this is going to be the metric for the phase space that is minimal in the sense that it includes just information about the metric in the underlying statistical manifold. So that's why I call this the information geometry of the phase space. Now, before I proceed further, I could comment that the fact that I am imposing the symmetry for the phase space, a flow reversal symmetry, does not mean that we're going to be imposing time reversal symmetry for the overall dynamics. The reason is the following. Here, I'm just discussing the geometry of the phase space. When we want to do real dynamics, we would like to have our theory be such that the particles or the fields or whatever are your ontic degrees of freedom are going to interact, are going to have interactions. And we would like to have those interactions be such that some of them, for example, electrodynamics, preserves the time reversal symmetry, while some other interactions, I don't know, a Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix or something like that in strong interactions, some other interactions might actually violate time reversal symmetry. So at this kinematical stage, we would like to keep open the possibility that time reversal invariance is going to be possible. We do that by saying in post that the phase space is flow reversal symmetric. When it comes to introducing violations, we are going to blame the violations not on the geometry of the phase space, but on the actual choice of Hamiltonian. It could be that your Hamiltonian includes a term with an electric dipole moment, for example. Then you would see that, yes, you will violate time reversal invariance, but it had nothing to do with the actual geometry of the phase space. All right. Next. Yes, here we have the geometry of the extended phase space of unnormalized probabilities. Nice and simple. But we really, what we are interested is in the space of normalized probabilities. So what we would like to do is figure out what is the induced metric, the metric that is induced on this phase space of normalized probabilities. So we're going to consider two neighboring points on the simplex, on the normalized simplex. One point is going to have coordinates rho phi, the other one rho plus delta phi, phi plus delta phi, so delta rho. Very good. Now, we had just decided that points that differ, that such that the phase differs by a constant, are equivalent to each other. So what we would like to do is figure out the distance between one point and points on the neighboring ray that is going to be parametrized by nu. So if you can see my hands, then you have a point in one ray, and then you have a neighboring ray, and we would like to figure out the distances for different points of the ray. All those points are equivalent. So we're going to define the distance on the phase space as being the distance between two neighboring rays as being the minimum over nu of this quantity that I have written here. So we're just going to minimize over nu to figure out which one of those points is closest to the original point rho phi. All right, the result is the following. It's a pretty nasty looking formula. But it has two features that are actually important for us. The first feature is that this is the Fubini study metric written in somewhat unconventional coordinates, rho, I'm sorry, this is not phi, this is not pi, this would be phi. I clearly changed in some slides, but I didn't change all the equations. This is supposed to be phi. Anyway, this is the Fubini study metric. It has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. It was discovered by Fubini and study back in 1903, 1904, way before anything about quantum mechanics was actually known. What is interesting about this particular derivation is that it shows that the Fubini study metric, this is a derivation of the Fubini study metric coming from concepts that are purely statistical. It has to do with the information geometry of the cotangent bundle associated to a simplex. Nothing to do with quantum mechanics. The other feature that's sort of interesting here is that I had mentioned earlier that the geometry of the simplex of unnormalized probabilities is spherically symmetric, and it involves these two arbitrary functions. What this expression down here shows is that A has disappeared, and of course, B has mostly disappeared except for its value at the normalization constraint. So what this means is that the particular embedding of the phase space of normalized probabilities into the phase space of unnormalized probabilities does not particularly matter. If it doesn't matter, we can choose the embedding space to be as simple as possible. Instead of having a generic, spherically symmetric space, we might as well choose these functions to be as simple as possible, just a constant here and zero, another constant there, which makes the phase space flat. This is going to, of course, simplify life tremendously, but the claim is that this is not a choice that will affect in any way the selection of the curves on the normalized phase space. This object chosen in this way, the embedding space being flat, is what is going to be later recognized in quantum mechanics as being the Hilbert space. This is Hilbert space. We do not know that yet. Very good. Here's the metric for the extended phase space. We can write it in terms of a metric tensor. Just we can read off what these components are. One of the amazing things about having a metric tensor is that once you have a metric tensor, you can raise and lower indices. So I'm going to do the following. I'm going to take the symplectic form, and I'm going to raise the first index using the inverse of this tensor here. The minus sign is there purely for convenience. I could have chosen the plus, but this makes life nicer. It's a convention. And what that gives us is another tensor. It is a tensor that takes vectors to vectors, and it has this particular form, not particularly enlightening. What's really important about this tensor here is that if you take the tensor and apply it twice, take any vector, apply J, then apply J again, what you get is minus the identity, which is crucially important for us because it says that not only we have a symplectic structure and a metric structure, we also have a complex structure. This is the origin of complex numbers in quantum mechanics. Spaces that have symplectic, metric, and complex structures that are compatible with each other in this particular way are called Kähler manifolds. What we are dealing here is with a very, very special Kähler manifold. It is a Kähler manifold in which the metric is coming from information geometry. And eventually the spaces we're going to be considering are flat. So this is a very, very simple kind of Kähler manifold, and you might start recognizing here that what you have is a complex projective space that we normally associate with the space of rays in a Hilbert space. So here you have the reason why we use complex numbers in quantum mechanics. It's a purely geometrical reason. Very good. Now that we have studied a little bit of the symplectic geometry, a little bit of the metric geometry, what I would like to point out that, well, just as I said in the beginning, the whole challenge in choosing the correct phase space was choosing the appropriate momentum. How do you pick up those privileged coordinates that help us define what the metric, what the symplectic form is? How do we do that? Well, I'm going to make another assumption that's basically motivated by hindsight from quantum mechanics. But what I'm going to say is, if we have for quantum mechanics, the phase spaces we need for quantum mechanics require us to perform a little bit of a redefinition on what our cotangent spaces were. And it comes about like this. If now you have your space of unnormalized probabilities, which by now we have decided is flat, we chose it to be flat, was an option, but why not? There you have a point on the space of unnormalized probabilities. There you have your cotangent space at that point. And what I'm going to do now to see how we can improve upon a choice of cotangent spaces is, there's the cotangent space. We're going to introduce complex coordinates. We have a complex structure, why not make use of it? So we're going to introduce complex coordinates. Here is the new coordinate psi, which of course it's a wave function, and its canonically conjugate momentum is given by this expression here, just I times the complex conjugate. It turns out that going from rho phi to psi and its momentum is a canonical transformation. So we are allowed to do that with one, so when we do that, the new points on this space in these coordinates are also going to be given by some kind of complex, with some kind of composite index. Mu equals one gives you the coordinate, mu equals two gives you the momentum conjugate to it. And it's sort of interesting that in these coordinates, the complex structure is given by this tensor. And so what's kind of cute, and you can see that this is starting to work, is that if you were to apply this guy here on there, you see that the action of J is going to be multiplication of the wave function by I and multiplication of the complex conjugate by minus I. So the complex tensor here, the complex structure tensor, really is behaving like complex numbers, multiplication by I. But there is something peculiar about this choice of this change of coordinates, which is that the point psi that you obtain with a particular phase phi turns out to be equivalent, is the same point psi, as what you get from the phase phi plus 2 pi. So what we're going to say is, all right, we're going to take this seriously, and we're going to identify on the phase space here points that differ by 2 pi. We're going to identify them. This works in this particular direction, but it also works in all other directions. So what this means is that the cotangent spaces that will be relevant for quantum mechanics are hypercubes of coordinate distance along the edges of 2 pi with opposite faces identified. So the cotangent space, of course, continues to be flat. It has to be, they're cotangent spaces. But now we have something like a periodic boundary conditions on those cotangent spaces. Let me see. Yes, okay. How does this manifest itself in quantum mechanics? Well, the phases, the coordinates on this space, on the cotangent space, can be taken to be, of course, multivalued. But the wave function then becomes, if you accept using hypercubes, the wave function is going to be single valued. Very good. So you can see that the single valuedness of the wave function and the multivaluedness of the phases is something that we are actually putting in as part of the redefinition of this phase space in such a way that it describes quantum mechanics and perhaps not the stock market or ecosystems. So this is important to the subject matter that we're trying to discuss. Very good. We have discussed Hamilton flows. Hamilton flows are those that preserve the symplectic form. What we want is flows that not only preserve the symplectic form, but they also preserve the metric, which makes them killing flows. When we impose both of those, then the conditions that these two are imposed on the Hamiltonian are actually kind of remarkable. it's just a matter of substituting into these expressions for the lead derivative. And what you get is that the second derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the psi vanishes, and with respect to the psi stars vanishes too, which means that the permissible Hamiltonian functions are going to be bilinear, linear in each one of these two functions. They're bilinear. There could be linear terms. There could be additional terms that only depend on psi or only depends on psi star. But those terms would make the Hamiltonian not gauge invariant. So that's where that condition comes in. If you properly want to preserve probabilities, preserve the normalization of probabilities, the Hamiltonian has to be gauge invariant. This is achieved here. So this is the main result of the talk. Because by the time you start looking at what are these Hamilton killing flows, then the evolution is going to be given by Maxwell's, by Hamilton's equations. Here we go. Derivative of psi is going to be the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the momentum. Or if you want to phrase it in terms of Poisson brackets, you're free to do so. They're completely equivalent. It's the same thing. And the moment that you choose Hamiltonians that are bilinear, then the equation that you get is Schrödinger equation, which is a linear Schrödinger equation. Many aspects of this geometry, the geometrical aspects of quantum mechanics, have been known for a long time. As far as I'm concerned, the first person I saw writing down the Schrödinger equation as Hamilton equation, that was Bohm. 1952, he did it in the context of his Bohmian mechanics. But it was promptly ignored, and it was rediscovered by several people. In fact, I think that all of these people rediscovered the symplectic and geometric structure of quantum mechanics independently of each other. So it was discovered and then ignored or forgotten and then rediscovered again and everything. But these guys have all one thing in common. They started from quantum mechanics and saw that there was an attending symplectic and geometric structure. What I'm doing here is different. I start from the geometric, symplectic and geometric structures of statistical manifolds, and I derive the framework, the kinematics of those curves that preserve those structures. So I'm going in the opposite direction. And to a large extent, you could say that at this point in the game, I'm not yet doing quantum mechanics. Very good. A quick summary of this first part of the talk. We start from ontological clarity. We need ontic microstates, a clear vision of what they are. And we discuss epistemic probabilities of those unknown microstates. The phase space is a cotangent bundle. The simplex plus those Hilbert cubes is what gives us the proper symplectic structure we need. The information geometry gives us the metric structure. Both of those give us the complex structure. The imposition of Hamilton killing flows is what leads to the Schrödinger equation. So that now at this state, what we would call quantum states are rays in a Hilbert space that happens to be optional, but very convenient. If you want to take advantage of linearity, then you're essentially forced to use it. And you see that the Born rule is automatically satisfied. The magnitude of the wave function really gives you probabilities.
Very good. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah. It's been already like 55 minutes, more or less. So
okay.
I just hope it should not be this section as long as the.
No. Okay. It's shorter. Okay, what perfect. I will do is I will. I find it difficult to skip pieces. Because of course it's part of the argument, but I will give you a flair, just a quick rundown of what are some of the pieces that make these dynamics together with the previous part give you a quantum mechanics. So I'll just go quickly over it.
Thank you.
So once again, we seek ontological clarity. The goal is to predict positions of particles. The particles have definite but unknown positions. So here we go. We predict positions. The positions are definite but unknown. So that gives us probabilities to be inferred on the basis of the information that's relevant to the physics, expressed in the form of constraints. And this information in the form of constraints is what requires us to include an additional function. So the phases of the wave functions enter in an entropic approach as constraints. Very good. So we're going to do, in order to figure out how the dynamics might actually work, we're going to consider, we're going to maximize an entropy to figure out the probability of a step, a jump from a position x to a position x prime. So this is, these are points in 3n dimensional space. Q, so x is a point in configuration space. Q is going to be a prior, and we're going to maximize this object here subject to appropriate constraints that actually include the physics. So here we go, the prior. We're going to assume that the motion of these particles is continuous. That's important because it says that if you have a continuous trajectory, you can analyze the motion of a large step in terms of the accumulation of short steps. So we're going to impose, figure out what this transition probability is for short steps. And so the way we do that is we say we choose the maximally ignorant prior distribution that does not include any correlations about different particles, and it's spherically symmetric. It just invoking the symmetry of the Euclidean space that underlies that. If I wanted curved spaces, then the metric tensor would not be delta, it would be something else. It can be done, we've done it. Very good. If we want to impose that the steps be short, but the probability distribution be otherwise maximally uninformative, we're going to choose this Lagrange multiplier to be large. N refers to the particles. A refers to x, y, z, the three coordinates of a particle. In the limit in which alpha goes to infinity, this refers to very, very, very short steps. Now, the main constraint. The main constraint is the one that introduces correlations and directionality to the motion. We're going to introduce this phase field. And the way this constraint works, this is a single constraint on the whole of phase space, on the whole of the configuration space. So we're going to impose that the change in this function be small. In other words, we're going to impose that the change in this phase field be as, this is just Taylor expanding, be a small quantity. This is a single constraint in configuration space. And this is the kind of thing that's going to lead to all sorts of non-localities. So important, this is where we introduce correlations. It's local, the constraint is local in configuration space, but non-local in three-dimensional space. The phase field is an angle. So you see some of these features that we imposed in the first part are appearing here, like here, for example. Additional constraints can be introduced too. For example, to describe electromagnetic interactions in a half and so on, I'll just write down what the constraint looks like for electromagnetic interactions. And when you maximize, so as you see, this is n constraints. Each particle reacts to an electromagnetic field on its own. So there are one constraint for each particle. There you have the vector potential. The transition probability that you get from maximizing that entropy is going to be something that includes the prior, and it includes Lagrange multipliers. Here we are. You can also see that because both constraints, this one here involves delta x, the expected value delta x, and so does this one, the constraints are not completely independent. You can change the phi and change the A appropriately so that you get the same probability distribution. This is where you see how gauge transformations appear, electromagnetic gauge transformations might appear. So here's the result. I'm not gonna put the vector potentials. I'm gonna not use them right now. I'll keep going without them to simplify the discussion. Very good, a generic displacement from this Gaussian distribution for short steps is one to involve an expected value and fluctuations. So now we have to discuss what are these Lagrange multipliers that appear here, the alpha n and the alpha prime. Very good. This is a short step. What we would like to do next is say how we accumulate these short steps to provide a true dynamics. And so the notion of time is going to be introduced to, in order to, as a bookkeeping device, in order to keep track of that. And here we go, do it. We can start from the fact that the joint distribution of two x's, one earlier, maybe the other one later, can be written by, from probability theory in this way. And if we integrate over x, what we have here is this rather remarkable equation that is just the properties of probability distributions. There is no assumption involved here. But now we're gonna make an assumption. We're gonna say, if this probability distribution refers to one instant in time, then this probability distribution will refer to the next instant in time, because after all, we concocted this transition probability to be a short step. So we're doing something very wacky here. We're taking an equation that just comes from probability distribution, but we are actually giving it a temporal dynamics interpretation. And we're gonna rewrite it in this form. Probability at T gets propagated to probability at T prime. And if this looks like a Chapman, Kolmogorov or Markovian equation, it's because that's what it is, except that I'm constructing the dynamics instant, from one instant to the next instant. I'm constructing time as I go along. These instants are ordered, yes, because the transition probability was obtained maximizing an entropy. So going in the opposite direction is not gonna be the same as doing this. So there is a natural arrow of time in this approach. Finally, we have to define what we mean by the interval between those instants. And so we're gonna define duration so that motion looks simple. This is the expected evolution for a short step, and these are the fluctuations. We would like to define those Lagrange multipliers in such a way as to simplify the motion as much as possible. And so we're gonna define, for example, this ratio to be such that it's proportional to delta t. This is so that the velocity is well-defined. So we, just as in mechanics, we define time so that velocities are well defined. You can see that this Lagrange multiplier here includes an n, it's particle dependent. So we have constants here that are particle dependent. And then we have just an overall constant floating around here so that this guy has the proper units of time. And of course I'm calling this m because eventually it will be a mass. So we're following the standard prescription of defining time so that motion looks simple. How about, here we have the a definition for the ratio. How about the other guys? Well, interestingly enough, we have a wide variety of choices here. We're gonna define alpha as being 1/delta to some power. If you choose gamma equals 0, namely alpha prime is a constant, then you reproduce Brownian paths the way you would have it in stochastic mechanics, like Nelson's stochastic mechanics. If on the other hand, you choose gamma equals 2, you get nice smooth Bohmian paths. So one of the things that's interesting here is that you have a variety of sub-quantum level possible trajectories, and they all eventually lead to the same quantum mechanics. At the quantum level, all of these are equivalent. At the sub-quantum level, they can be completely different. So from now on, I'll just stick to the Bohmian paths because the trajectories are smooth. It's a little bit simpler, perhaps. Then the probability distribution that we have figured out is something like that. I introduced a mass tensor. to make life look neater. The expected particle velocity is the object we had before. We can rewrite it. It's the same equation we have down here. We can rewrite it in this form where the capital phi is just the old phi with an H. So if this starts looking familiar from, say, Hamilton-Jacobi theory or from Bohmian mechanics or from Nelson's stochastic mechanics, it's precisely because it's identical to it. And from here, you can also figure out the variance of those velocities. And you can see that as delta t goes to zero, the variance goes to zero, which is what gives you that the trajectories are looking like Bohmian trajectories, nice and smooth. Very good. We have entropic dynamics now written in this integral form, but we can write it in differential form. And it takes this form here where v, the velocity v is the velocity of probability flow. It's the one that we had before. Now, this is remarkable, but we can also write this continuity equation in this Hamiltonian form. We can find an H that does it. So now you see where we're starting to fix the gaps in the previous kinematical discussion. Once we have from entropic dynamics a clear candidate for what is going to be the associated momentum that's conjugate to the rows, we have the Hamiltonian. This is just an integration constant. The next step is going to be to determine it. So here we have our Hamilton equation. This determines rho phi as being the phi, as being the suggested canonical pair. Very good. We have a symplectic form. Here it is. We have a metric structure. There it is, with a bunch of H's because I changed some of the definitions. We have a complex structure. We can use complex coordinates. And if we look for time evolution, and what is the Hamiltonian? Well, the Hamiltonian flow and the Killing flow will impose such conditions on the Hamiltonian. The result of those is a bilinear form for the Hamiltonian. And if we impose that the previous Hamiltonian that I had written down, take this bilinear form, it gives me something like this. This is an appropriate choice of this function rho that makes it bilinear. There is this extra function here, which is that we recognize that freedom is the freedom of a potential. And we can then now reintroduce the covariant derivatives if we want to have electromagnetic interactions. Very good. The equations of motion can be written in Poisson bracket form, or in terms of rho and phi, or in terms of psi. And here we have the result. The equation of motion is the Schrödinger equation. We're done, finished. So summary, entropic dynamics can lead to a quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is a Hamiltonian dynamics in the classical sense with the appropriate choice of coordinates. The coordinates are not positions and momenta, but probabilities and their conjugate momenta. There is no need for quantum probabilities. Once you have a clear ontological commitment to what's real, then no need for quantum probabilities. There is no need for quantum probabilities. Classical probabilities are all that's required. In fact, I actually prefer to think that these probabilities are neither classical nor quantum. They're just probabilities. That's all you need for inference. Finally, the positions of these particles are ontic variables. If you were worrying about what that t that I introduced as entropic time and what that m that I introduced in the Lagrange multipliers, if you were worrying what they are, well, they are the parameters that appear in the Schrödinger equation. They are the objects that appear here. It is the Schrödinger equation that is calibrated so that we have clocks or that we have mass measurement devices. So since these are the parameters that appear in the Hamiltonian and measurement devices are calibrated to measure them, this is time, and that is mass. The Schrödinger equation has turned out to be linear, time reversible, gauge invariant, and no Hilbert spaces needed to be postulated. The Hilbert spaces are just a convenient choice of embedding space. Thank you very much. I'm open for questions.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Sorry if I went over time a little bit.
It's no problem. We still have time for questions. I can take them. There's also questions in the chat that I sort of did not see during the talk. I think it's better if people just raise their hands, and if you have a question in the chat, you can repeat.
Yes.
Okay, so Lucien, you can ask.
Hi, yeah, thank you for the talk. It's very interesting. I feel now compelled to learn more. But I had a sort of basic question, which is the number of distinct ontic states. So it seemed like your eyes labeled ontic states, so that if I was discrete,
I call them J here, not I, J with imaginary unit.
Your J was finite, it seems, at least in the first part of your talk.
And if
you had a finite dimensional Hilbert space, would J correspond to the dimension of the Hilbert space? Is that the case?
Yes.
Okay. So I have a sort of theorem that shows that even for finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, you need an infinite number of distinct ontological states, and it's sort of a very general theorem, just considering a sort of preparation and measurement scenario where you prepare different things. So I'm just wondering what's different in what you're doing. It seems like you have a different notion of probability, or
this is the standard notion of probability.
Okay, what is different? I'm not sure you know this paper I'm talking about,
but I don't.
You can imagine you could prove something like this just by considering, sort of very small changes in your preparation, say for a qubit, and then you have there always exists a measurement that will perfectly discriminate sort of
I understand.
And you can bootstrap that into a proof that there's an infinite number of ontological states. So I just wonder what happens.
I think the issue here is, what do I mean by an ontological commitment? When I say that the particles have definite positions, I am definitely saying the positions of the particles are there for real. But the particles have no momenta. So maybe this is where you're going. Just because you manage to measure a momentum, that doesn't make the momentum something ontic. So the particles have no momentum. The way I can actually think about this is by saying, well, how do you actually measure momentum? You never really measure momentum. What you measure is actually position. For example, you have a wave function that's coming at you. You put a magnetic field. You deflect different plane wave components in different directions. And then you put a detector at the very end that measures position. Mm-hmm. So this is a little bit like a Sturm-Gerlach device. You never really measure the spin. You measure position. Mm-hmm. The only thing that's ontic is position. On the basis of that measurement of position, you can infer all sorts of other properties of the wave function. So the way I think about momentum, spin, angular momentum, any of the energy, any of the other observables, is that they are not really observables, they are inferables, they're properties of the wave function.
Okay.
So the moment, that, the way I would say it is that it's not that when you say if you were to say I have this black box that measures momentum, that's where I'm getting off the bus. And I'm saying, no, you don't have a black box. You have a magnetic field that separates beams in different directions, and you have detectors that just measure position. So everything is position.
So at the end, I think you indicated that there was some, that the wave function also had, because at the very beginning of your talk, you placed yourself in the epistemic side of the
Well, the wave function is completely epistemic. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So okay. Momentum does not exist.
Okay.
So when you see a truck coming at you and you say, I better get out of the way, it's not because the momentum is going to kill you. No, the truck has no momentum. It's because on the basis of the wave function of the truck and yours, you're going to predict that your future states are going to be spread over the pavement very, very thin, unless you actually get out of the way. So the momentum is a tool that we use in order to make predictions about the future, but the momentum itself is just a part of the wave function that lives in our heads, not in the real world. Now quantum mechanics is weird, and no matter how you slice it, you can make quantum mechanics look a little bit more reasonable in some respects, but there are others that really will clash with your intuition from previous studies.
So maybe I can ask sort of a question sort of in a different way, that you have, if like in classical probability theory, if you have a finite number of ontic states, then you expect that the states live in a simplex.
Yes.
But you clearly don't have that here. Is that right?
Well, you do.
You have continuous
quantum die. In the case of the quantum die, you have one of those alternatives. The states of the corners of the simplex correspond are the epistemic states that corresponds to having certainty about those ontic states, right?
Yeah.
That's the way I would say it. I would still like to differentiate between the ontic microstates and the corners of the simplex, which are epistemic states, our knowledge about the actual microstates.
Okay.
When you go to infinite dimensions, of course, everything gets a little bit murky.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see that there is any problem, really. In fact,
simplex, then just a classic, just a finite dimensional simplex, like a finite number of vertices. So finite number of ontics.
No, that's right. Yes. Yes.
And the evolution is discrete usually. I mean, like you can't have continuous evolution, but it seemed like you had continuous evolution even in the finite dimensional.
In the infinite dimensional case of positions, then of course the simplex is not something that we can visualize.
Yeah.
In fact, the corners of the simplex are actually going to be outside of the Hilbert space, right?
Unbounded.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. I'll
Sure.
There's a question from Tim.
Tim, I'm glad you made it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I missed the very beginning. And look, quite honestly, you know, a lot of the math is above my pay grade, or I'd have to get the papers and work through it very slowly. But I just wanted to ask some conceptual questions to get my feet a little better. So one is about this epistemic aspect. So one way of thinking, if you work a lot with Bohmian mechanics, after a while, you know, you say, look, the fundamental equations, the Schrodinger equation, the guidance equation, they're both first order in time. And then you say it there's sort of this analogy, whereas in classical physics, the initial conditions for a problem are given by the positions and momenta. Here, the initial conditions are given by the configuration, that is the positions and the wave function, right? So kind
yes.
of this, yes. this corresponds to what you were just saying, that the momenta are not velocity times mass, right? There's this other
yes.
real physical degree of freedom that sort of comes in. And it's because of that, that you can do everything first order in time, right? And you don't do it in terms of accelerations, right? Everything
yes.
BDT. But then you keep saying how, in your view, these states are epistemic, and you just
yes.
talk about them living in your head.
Well,
I don't think how something that lives in my head can get my particles can make it
question.
The case that the particles in my body are going to be smattered all over the. All
they're not
going to
be smattered; just spread out. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
you know, with the truck, I mean, that's not something in my head, right? That's something that's going into my head in the wrong way. But,
still, it is the information. It is the information that you need to to incorporate into your scheme in order to make predictions about the future. But let me you pointed out something really interesting or perhaps disturbing about this entropic dynamics. In the Bohmian mechanics, there is a pilot wave that guides the particles.
Yeah.
Fine. Here, there is also a pilot wave. I would say the phase, the momentum conjugate to the probabilities, is a pilot wave. It does not guide the particles. No, nothing guides the particles here. It guides the probabilities. This is a dynamics of probabilities.
Yeah.
So in a very way,
I'm having a hard time.
I understand.
I understand if you got particles and something's telling them where to go.
Nothing is telling them where to go.
The probabilities are going somewhere, but these are epistemic.
They're epistemic probabilities. And so what the dynamics here is a mechanics without a mechanism. Nothing here is telling you how the particles are going to move. All that this scheme is telling you is where you have a chance of finding the particles. That's all. If the probability is high over here, and then later you find that the probability is high over there, you are going to naturally make the inference that the particles must have moved. Now, it's true, probabilities do not move. Probabilities are not a fluid. Probabilities may only increase and decrease according to the information that's available to you. So this very peculiar mechanics, and this is where it differs from Newtonian mechanics, nothing is pushing the particles. Maybe something is, but in this approach, we never talk about that. The theory here is completely silent about anything moving the particles. The theory is purely a dynamics of probabilities.
Okay, so let me just ask, make sure I understand. You're open conceptually to the idea that, yes, there's something in nature, right? Not in my head or anybody's head. There is something in nature that's, determining where the particles go. There's a second question, which is what a good inference scheme is for me to make predictions, given my information about all this, right? And this formalism may address that, but you're at least open to somebody coming along and saying, look, I think, quite apart from what anybody believes or infers or anything, there's some account of actually why the particles do what they do.
There may be. Think about it this way. There are always certain features of questions we do not ask. In physics, like for example, for in Newtonian or Galilean physics, there is this very, very strange phenomenon that if you do not do anything to a particle, it just keeps moving in a straight line forever and ever and ever. And for us, it's something that's very, very natural to imagine. But I can imagine that in the Middle Ages or for the old Greeks, that would have been a completely preposterous idea that something could just keep moving on and on and on. Why? What is it that keeps it moving? We change the whole idea by saying there is nothing to stop it, right? So why wouldn't it keep moving? In the case of quantum mechanics, or this a particular approach to quantum mechanics, I would say I don't really need to ask what is it that is pushing the particles. I only need to ask where do I expect to find them.
Okay.
Probability approach changes the picture completely.
Okay. I'm going on too long. I'll just make one quick comment. I understand what you're saying about the Greeks. Let me just re-describe the history in a slightly different way. I would say Newton comes in with his first law of motion and lays that down as a law, right? And says, that's what the law of inertia tells you. And of course, every theory has to have its fundamental laws, which aren't explained by anything further. It's you know, so there the answer at the bottom is the only thing it can be, because that's the bottom. You say that's just the way it is. And then other things
absolutely
you explain in terms of that, right? Yeah.
Here, what we are doing that is sort of mimicking that is not really at the mechanical level, but at the inferential level. Right. When I identify what are the constraints on the basis of which I'm going to update both my probabilities and update the phases, when I say these are the pieces of information that will allow me to make useful predictions, right? That's where I'm putting the physics. I'm sort of bypassing completely the issue of whether there are forces pushing the particles or not.
Okay.
There might be. Very good. I guess Nitika had a question.
Hello. Thank you for the interesting talk. I just wanted to ask you regarding you were talking about position and momentum and you getting off the bus. If people talk about momentum being measurable directly, so how would you talk about the scenario where a photon enters a black box? The black box has some atom where, depending on the frequency and thus the momentum of the photon and electron, goes up and then emits some fluoro, some photon that we can detect, and therefore detect the frequency of the photon entering the box. How would you talk about this?
Okay, I would always, I think that the issue here is always going to be you only detect positions. You only detect positions. If you then, on the basis of that detection of position, you can make inferences about what the wave function must have been, you can actually translate that into, say, a measurement of frequency or a measurement of momentum or something like that. I can imagine that you establish the initial wave functions, the initial probabilities and the initial phases, and you allow the system to evolve. And then at some point you say, well, I have photons coming out. Let me put a prism in front, and that will deflect the different colors in different directions. And I will then detect the photon at some point. In fact, you never really have a direct measurement of frequency. What you may have is a measurement of the or detection of the presence of a photon within a certain detector that goes click, right? We exchange all of the complications of interpretation that happens in the quantum measurement problem by just saying you only measure positions, and depending on what structures you put before the position detector, you can say that that detection of position gives you information about momentum or frequency or whatever. I think it works. It works in general. We analyzed a few of those, and I do not see any problem. Does that help you a little bit?
A little bit. I need to think about this a little more, but yeah, I mean, at least in this talk, it's hard to accept this proposition, but I can try to think about this a bit more.
One of the weird ways in which people have tried to cope with the weirdness of quantum mechanics is by increasing the ontology tremendously, many worlds or maybe ontic wave functions, which are you have one particle and then an ontic wave function. That's an incredible number of an incredible increase in the onticity of the whole thing, right? In a weird sense, I'm going in the opposite direction of saying that of all the objects that you could imagine being ontic about the system, all the properties like momentum, energy, angular momentum, just position. That's going in the opposite direction. And I think that I can recover everything else. Now, there is a trick here, or there is a challenge. What's the challenge here? The challenge is that when I try to derive quantum mechanics by starting from a given ontology, it's very easy to get the ontology wrong. If you get the ontology wrong, you're going to get everything wrong. So one has to sort of like guess, have a moment of inspiration where you say, well, I'm going to build a theory for particles, and I'm going to assume their positions are real. I could try to derive a theory for fields. We've done that. Fields propagating in curved space-time, fields propagating in curved space-times that are dynamic. We've done those things. So it's you just change the basic ontology and proceed. Certain features that turn out to be ontic at one level of description might end up looking within the model as being epistemic. Like, for example, if you assume that your basic ontology is one of fields, then the particles are just different excited states of the fields. Those are epistemic. The particles are not real anymore. Typical problem that one may arise is, for example, okay, I have particles, they're real. Let's add a spin. Is the spin going to be part of the ontic furniture of the world? Or is the spin going to be part of the constraints and therefore part of the epistemic? So we have to make that decision. Once we make that decision, the entropic dynamics framework allows you to just run the machinery and draw conclusions, which may or may not agree with reality.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Nosrat?
Hello.
Hello, yes.
I have a question, maybe from the history. There was in the 18.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. You're breaking.
In 1980 decade of the past century, there was a paper, some papers from Caglioni, Italian physicist, geometry from quantum mechanics. And they have maybe some similar formulation of the quantum mechanics. And they have a curved momentum space. And they quantize curved momentum space for quantizing gravity. What is the relation of your formalist to that formalist?
I have no idea. I just don't know. The closest formulation to what I've been presenting here, the closest formulation that I know of, is that by Marcel Reginato and Michael Hall. They also propose a Hamiltonian dynamics of probabilities. So they have something that in many respects resembles what I've been saying here. Their approach is also based on information geometry. There are important differences, but it's the closest, I would say. Yeah, this Italian guy you mentioned, no, I do not know about it.
The maximal acceleration is from that guy, and they have proposed that curved momentum space can help the quantizing gravity, and they use curved momentum space for quantizing for the geometry.
Okay, no, I have no idea. I can tell you one thing, however, when I try to apply these ideas to do something that resembles the coupling of a scalar relativistic field to a dynamical space-time, what one ends up getting is something like a semi-classical gravity. Mm-hmm. Now, semi-classical gravity has been the object. So this is not quantum gravity. What we get is a theory that in one limit gives you nice gravity. In another limit, it gives you nice quantum field theory, right? And when you put the two together in this theory, there are a number of interesting features. It's a semi-classical gravity, but because of the way the quantum mechanics was cooked up, most of the objections that people have raised through the decades about semi-classical gravity do not apply. Because most of the objections about semi-classical gravity have to do with the nature of the quantum mechanical measurement problem. So they're very intimately connected. You change your interpretation of what quantum measurement is, and therefore you automatically are going to change the the way you interpret semi-classical gravity as well, right? It's not a quantum theory, but it has an interesting feature, this semi-classical gravity. When you apply these ideas of entropic dynamics to systems in a flat or fixed gravitational field, you get a decent quantum field theory. Schrodinger equation, you get a functional equation, Schrodinger functional equation. You get everything that you would expect in quantum field theory. Perfect. But when you allow to the scalar fields to interact with gravity, and the gravity is now dynamical, one of the things you find is that the theory no longer gives you unitary evolution. So the superposition principle is very jeopardized under those conditions. So I would be willing to claim that by putting together a theory of this type that accurately represents quantum mechanics in one limit and accurately represents gravity in another, and you bring them together and you see that you no longer have a fully quantum theory, that this is going to be one of the first predictions of this kind of approach. You have violations of quantum mechanics in a theory that violates, that incorporates both gravity and quantum fields. Why don't I just go around saying something like that? Yes, we prove that there are violations of quantum mechanics. The thing is, well, when you come up with crazy ideas like this, you are not allowed to say, I have made great discoveries, unless you have covered all the bases in the theory. You have to not only be able to describe non-relativistic particles, but non-relativistic particles with spin, not only that you have fields in interaction with gravity fields, but you have fields that have spin and color and flavor. You have to be able to reproduce all the other features of quantum mechanics of the standard model that we know are very reliable. And so I do not know at this point, for example, or I do not know because we just haven't gotten there, but I do not know how to reproduce the full standard model in this language. The moment I can do fermion fields coupled to non-abelian gauge theories in a background that is gravity and all that, then we can start making good conclusions about whether we have predictions about violations of quantum mechanics. At this point in the game, it's just promising.
Thank you so much. Thank you,
sir. Thank you.
Okay, I think it's, well, we had a good question period. It was, personally, I enjoyed a lot. So I
thank you very much.
I encourage everybody to thank again, Ariel. And it was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Lucien, you want to say something? No. Okay. Well, okay. Good weekend, everybody.
Very good. Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you for the invitation. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the talk. It was great.
Thank you.